it's a tremendous privilege to be involved, because a scientist looks into the details of the Creator's creation. And if anyone, any of the young people here, have the ability and the inclination, I would urge you, this is a field that you will not regret going into. You just have to go into it with your eyes wide open, knowing that you are going to be bombarded with secular humanist lies. But the truth underneath always points to the Creator. Now, I was asked to give this presentation yesterday, and I hadn't brought much material with me, so I wandered around this morning and I noticed one or two wonderful things in this marvelous place that we have the privilege of being in. So this isn't anything like what I've given before, but wherever you look, the glory of God just shows itself forth if you've got eyes to see it. Because as Paul says in Romans chapter 1 verse 20, the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things which are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. And if you look to the heavens, you see the amazing bodies up there that God alone made. And he calls them all forth. He calls them all by name. He knows every one of them. And if you're fortunate enough to be able to get onto a telescope, you can see far more than you can see when you just walk outside. And beautiful though it is when you walk outside, if you have the privilege of being able to get onto the equipment which can look at his creation in detail, you can see things that, well, we should just stand in awe. Wherever you look out in the skies, all these things which he has made, many of them, millions of them, and he just spoke it all into being with one word. But we're surrounded, wherever we go, by the miracles of his creation. This is a tree which we all walked past, or ran past perhaps, on Saturday morning. I don't know if you noticed it, but like all the trees that God made, it's an absolute miracle. You look at this tree and you can see little yellow clusters. If you look a little closer, we can see them a bit better. And each of those little clusters that look yellow there, it's a bunch of seeds. And each one has a little wing attached to it. And if the wind blows and they come off, it acts like a helicopter and spins round and round and can go and find somewhere to take root. And you look at one single tree, and each of these bunches, something like 100 seeds. You've got thousands of seeds on one tree, and every single one can become another tree. And every single one of those can produce thousands of these seeds every year. And you know, man can make some wonderful things. The feats of modern engineering and technology are marvelous. But there's not one single thing that has been made which can reproduce itself. We cannot come anywhere near a tree or a flower or grass, anything that God has made, so far surpasses man's ability, that we should stand in awe every time we see seeds on a tree. Now also on our run or walk on Saturday, I came back with the girls and we got stuck in this little lot. I'm sure you'll recognize it. It's at the new sports field where ground has been bulldozed away, and as we walk through this you can see where heels have slipped. This is clay. And one might think, well, just clay, so what? But every single thing that God has made is a miracle. Even the clay, it is an astounding material. And a scientist has the privilege of looking into things like this. It may not sound very glamorous, but this particular clay that we've got here, it's an Arcadia clay, is very interesting because it swells when it gets wet. And it's very important that it does, because when animals walk over the ground, especially when they're in a large number, they tend to follow one track. And as the animals walk down this one track, they destroy the vegetation. They dig out a rut. They compact it, and you end up with a situation where if it rains, you're going to get water flowing down there, it will be eroded out, and you'll end up with an erosion gully. Now for hundreds of years, thousands of years, great tracts of Africa have had huge herds of animals migrating seasonally, beating tracks which one would think would be eroded into dongas every rainy season. And that does happen in certain places where there is no clay. But when the animals have spoiled this ground and compacted it, and it's all ready to be eroded away, this clay not only expands, but as it's there, bare, exposed under the sun, it shrinks and contracts and cracks, and the cracks go deep into the ground. Then when the rain comes, before it can erode it all the way, it flows down those cracks, gets down to the bottom, and starts swelling the clay, and it heaves upwards. And as the water fills the cracks, it heaves. And clays like this can increase their volume by 20%. So if you've got 1 meter that swells, it ends up 200 millimeters higher. It's no longer a gully that the water's going to flow down and erode out. And the seeds that have fallen down those cracks have got a wonderful opportunity to germinate. And so the animals have been able to migrate across Africa for thousands of years, and the whole place is not eroded down to bedrock. And if it weren't for clay like this, we wouldn't have the soil that we've got. Now, clay comes from rock, and rock can't do this swelling. But God has made a wonderful way for this to happen. The material that comes from the rock, that it disintegrates as it gets wet, it has alternate sheets of mainly silicon, but other minerals as well, and then an octahedral sheet, which is aluminium or magnesium, and these things are well balanced electrically, so they stick together. And since if they stick together, then they can't swell. But if you look here at this clay, this is where the bulldozer has scooped the soil away, and it's left a bit. You can see the original dam left there. And you can see these roots, they're coming all the way down. You can see them coming right down to the bottom. Now, those plants send out roots in order to find minerals like magnesium, iron, to feed the plant. So the plant can grow, and then the animals can come along and eat it, and they can get these essential minerals as well. Well, how does the plant get those minerals? The things like magnesium and iron, which those plants need, are locked into those sheets that we saw. And they have positive charge. Magnesium, for example, it's got positive charge of 2, so it's being held on to 2 oxygen atoms. So the plant comes along and sees a magnesium ion that it needs. And it squirts out a hydrogen ion right next to it. Now that magnesium ion is sharing an electron with oxygen ions down there. Now it's got a hydrogen ion and it shares with the oxygen, so now the magnesium is only held on with 1 charge. So then the plant comes and squirts another hydrogen ion next to it. Now the magnesium ion is loose. So the plant grabs it, it goes into the... and then it goes to the next one. But while the plant is doing this, it's disturbing the crystal structure. And now that the magnesium has gone, and you've got a couple of hydrogen ions, combines with oxygen and we get water, and now we've got an imbalance. And the more the soil does this, the bigger the imbalance. And now we've got this soil structure which has got a negative charge. So the water sucks in positive ions, and as it sucks them in, it separates the soil and it swells. So the plants do all the work needed to restore the soil and keep everything just the way it should be. Now, of course, if you've got soil that can increase in size 20% because it's sucking in water like this, you do have problems. For example, if you try and build on it, after you've built, the soil heaves up 20%, you're going to find problems like this. But, well, that's another interesting problem to solve. Now, we've looked at the great picture, the stars, the heavens. We've looked at the tiny little insignificant things like grains of clay. And we've got a huge amount of the glory of God displayed in the inanimate world. But when we come to the living world, then we've got even more to be amazed at. The simplest living organism is reckoned to be a bacterium. And people seem to have a pretty grim view of bacteria. We think of them in terms of disease. Now, there are a few bacteria which cause disease. And usually, they will only cause disease if you have not fed your body properly to keep its defenses in order. If you look at Deuteronomy, God tells you how to avoid the evil diseases which cling to people who don't obey what he says. And he gives a whole series of rules to live by and says, if you live by these rules, you won't get sick. And at the end of this whole series, he says, but if you do not do what I say, then these diseases will cling to you. And one aspect of what he gives there is what to eat. And if we want, we can take that seriously and say, do we want these diseases or do we want to be disease-free? And we have the choice. Are we going to eat what God says? Or are we going to not bother to listen? And if you do not look after your body by eating the right things, then bacteria can be a problem. But the vast majority of bacteria are there because they are needed for the whole process of maintaining the earth. Almost all bacteria are there to break down dead things, to stop them being a source of problem, disease, etc., and to break them down so that they can be used again by plants to produce the next crop of food. Now, bacteria are so important in God's economy that he has produced an amazing set of creatures to look after them, and they're called viruses. There are so many viruses in the world, it would be very difficult to even estimate how many there are. In every teaspoon of water you get from a pond or the ocean or even from the tap, there are many thousands. And they are essential for keeping the bacteria alive, because bacteria have to work in very unfavorable circumstances sometimes, in poisonous conditions. And it would be pretty bad for everything if the bacteria couldn't work and break down waste material just because there were poisons there. Now, viruses cannot reproduce themselves. It takes a huge amount of biological engineering to reproduce anything. There are all sorts of factories, machines inside a living organism that are needed for reproduction. So a virus sends its genetic material into a bacterium, and that genetic material includes not only what it needs to reproduce itself, but it also includes genetic material from bacteria that its parent infected. So this bacterium, when it gets this genetic material, it can extract from it coding to cope with poisons, with conditions that it's not used to itself. And it can also add coding that it has to deal with poisons that it can deal with. And so the ability to resist poisons can be passed on from bacterium to bacterium. And this is an amazing system to enable bacteria to work in all sorts of situations. Again, we tend to have a very negative view of viruses, because some of them, a very tiny proportion of what there are, can bring disease to people. But again, they are usually only able to do that if the body is not in good condition. If one takes the precautions, if one obeys what God says in Deuteronomy, then God tells you these diseases will not cling to you. So our negative view of viruses and bacteria is very largely our own fault for not doing what God says to stay healthy. Well, it's wonderful to look even at the smallest thing like a virus that God has made in the living world. But when we come to look at man, then everything about man is mind-boggling. And every single cell is a source of wonder and amazement. Every single cell has a thread of DNA. Now, that DNA can do absolutely nothing. Nothing whatsoever. It is just a super miniaturized, super efficient data storage system. But the body has a whole set of machines which can use that data. Now, that data has to be accurate. If there are any mistakes in it, it doesn't work. It's like a computer program. If you've got a computer program and you have a copying mistake in it, it's not going to work properly. Now, this is a cross-section, one atom thick through a thread of DNA, and you can see this amazing pattern, this amazing symmetry. It all has to be exact. And each different cross-section, it's different, but the sequence of cross-sections, thousands of millions of them, have to be exact. But by itself, absolutely perfect, it can still do nothing. But the body has a whole series of machines. Now, one of them opens up a section of the DNA which the cell has decided it needs the information for. This DNA is very, very long. It contains a huge amount of information. So when the cell decides it needs some information, it goes to the exact spot, opens up just as much as it needs, and puts in RNA to copy the information. And then this copied information, it's called messenger RNA, it has a copy of the code found in the DNA, and it codes for amino acids in sets of three codons. And it comes to a machine called the ribosome. That machine is made of proteins, and the ribosome is able to read this messenger RNA, something like a computer reading head, something like that, and it reads the code and realizes it needs that particular amino acid. And it has a cell phone system, so it calls up a transfer RNA which carries just the right amino acid. And that comes into the ribosome, and the machine takes its amino acid off it, Meanwhile, the next one is called in, the next code is read, this comes in, and if the codes are right, the ribosome takes the first amino acid and chains it on. Then this transfer RNA can go off and find another amino acid, and the whole system is repeated, and gradually the ribosome builds up a stack of amino acids in a long chain. Now again, this stack, this long string of amino acids, is useless. It can't do anything. But it can do something when it's made into the right shape. But it's a very complex shape. And it is so complex that a Cray supercomputer, working full time, non-stop, takes about 6 months to calculate the shape that it has to be bent into. But this string of amino acids is taken to a folding jig. And that folding jig folds it to the exact shape, and it does it very, very quickly. And once it's folded into the exact shape, it's now a protein which can do a useful job in the cell. There's a class of proteins called enzymes, and these enzymes work on material that the body has to deal with, raw materials that come in from the food you eat. And the enzymes work on particular substrates, like glucose, for example. And in order to work, they have to be an accurate fit to the substrate. They have to be right to bond atom. And when they are right, they can work very quickly. Phosphatase, for example, speeds up reactions vital for cell signaling by 10 to the power 21 times. That's one with 21 zeros after it, allowing essential reactions to take place in 1/100 of a second. Without it, it would take 1 trillion years. The body needs, each cell needs about 2,000 enzymes. And all of them work like this. They speed up reactions which by themselves would take vast amounts of time, but they all happen very quickly because the body needs things to work very quickly. And all the things that we have looked at, we've looked at the machine that opens it up, we've looked at the ribosome which makes sense of the information, we've looked at the folding jig, and there are many others involved. All of them need energy to work. And they all use energy from a substance called ATP. And ATP is made in a machine, which is also made of proteins. And that machine, it has an electric motor. And this electric motor spins at 10,000 revs per minute. Now that's quite quick. When I have the time, which is not very often, I like to play with model aeroplanes. And this has an engine which turns that propeller at 10,000 revs per minute. If you get your finger in there at that speed, you're probably going to end up at the hospital. It's quite a good speed. This motor turns at 10,000 revs per minute, and with each revolution it produces 3 molecules of ATP. So it's producing 30,000 molecules of ATP every minute. And that ATP is needed by every structure, every protein, every part of the cell. And if the supply of ATP stops just for a moment. The cell dies. There is a poison called cyanide. And if you are an Agatha Christie fan, you'll remember that she likes cyanide very much. It's a very quick acting poison. You can be dead with the glass still to your lips. 30 seconds after you take in your gulp of cyanide, you're dead. And the reason is, cyanide stops the ATP machine working. If that stops working, you die. Now it's interesting to note that the ATP machine is made of proteins which are specified in the DNA. The DNA is useless on its own. It's only got information in it. But the ATP machine, it's specified in the DNA. The ribosome is specified in the DNA. All the machines are specified in the DNA. But none of the information in the DNA can be of any use without all of them in the first place. We have an amazingly complex, utterly and completely interdependent system. Everything has to be perfect, otherwise nothing works. Well, we get back to our simple bacterium, and you'll notice that it's got a tail. Now, some have only one tail, some have several tails. There is a very well-known bacterium called E. coli. Every one of us has millions of them in our intestines. And these, they have, I think it's three or four of these flagella. Those flagella are really quite amazing. They have a shaft going through the wall of the cell, and that bearing is almost frictionless. I don't think it has been possible to measure any friction, but nothing can be totally frictionless, but it's so close to frictionless that it's just about impossible to measure the friction. It has an electric motor, which it's a proton motor. It's delivered a supply of protons, which it uses to turn the flagellum. It can turn at any controlled speed between 0 and 100,000 revs per minute in either direction. And it can be spinning at 100,000 revs a minute in one direction, and within a quarter of a turn it can stop and start spinning in the opposite direction. This is reckoned to be the most efficient electric motor known. An absolute marvel of engineering, and this is just one tiny part of a simple so-called bacteria. One can see why Morabitz got to a probability of it happening of 1 chance in 100,000 million. There is so much amazing complexity in the simplest bacterium that it is absolutely mind-boggling. And we know now more than David did. But David said, "I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well." Well, we know, even in more detail than David did, God's works are absolutely astoundingly marvelous. "When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and stars which thou hast ordained, What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? We look at his creation and we see he is able to do amazing, wonderful things. Why should he be concerned with people like us when the very best that we can do, the very highest technology we can rise to, is primitive compared to what he can do? You know, we are so proud of thinking how great we are and what good things we can do. And compared to what God can do, we can do nothing. How grateful we should be that he does care and he does visit us and even listen to our prayers. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes.
Is it possible to reconcile evolution with creation? Now, those that say because with one day with God is 1,000 years, it could have taken any amount of time, or the 6-day creation which we read in the Bible, and some people try and reconcile evolution and creation.
Right, well, with God, 1,000 years are as one day is 1,000 years. God created time. Time belongs to him. He knows the end from the beginning. We are stuck in time. We are subject to its dictates. We don't know the end from the beginning. Now, the two places in the Bible where it says 1,000 years as a day, and a day as 1,000 years. One, the first one, is in Psalms, and it is pointing to God's patience in dealing with sinners. You say, why doesn't God act and destroy the wicked? Well, he is patient. And in, I think it's, is it 1 Peter or 2 Peter? He's quoting Psalms. And he's quoting it in the same context of God's patience with sinners, allowing them time to repent. And in effect it's saying, well, don't count on the fact that you've got away with it so far. God's been patient, but he's going to judge you. So the fact that time is not a limiting factor with God has nothing to do with the fact that time certainly is a limiting factor on everything to do with the existence we know about, including life. So as far as this life that we know anything about, evolution requires millions of years. And it is totally irrelevant whether God is mindful of millions of years or not. His creation certainly is. So it's not an argument that holds any water. The fact that God is not involved in time makes no justification for evolution. If evolution were to stand the faintest ghost of a chance, it would need a vast amount of time, vastly more than the longest ages of the existence of the universe, vastly longer.
It's also significant that in Genesis it says, and there was morning and there was evening, but it's that time. It gives a defining period of...
Yes, well, we'll look at that on Tuesday, if you can come to the Tuesday lecture, we'll look a little more at time. Yes?
And slightly off topic, but in your first lecture on science, you did a comparison between Christian science and secular science. And you said that Einstein's relativity is the secular science, and how when they disproved that it wasn't accepted. was just wondering if there's anything specific in the theory of relativity that's anti-Christian or goes against the Bible, or is it just that the secular scientists have decided that this is correct?
Well, we'll look at that tomorrow. There are three very big attacks on the Bible. There are three very major attacks which are said to show that the Bible is not true. There used to be more. There used to be a lot of archaeological attacks. But as archaeology has discovered new things, I think pretty well all of the archaeological attacks have fallen away. For example, they used to say, well, the Bible talks about the Hittites, and there are no Hittites, so the Bible's wrong. Then we dug up the Hittites. And it's been like that all the way through with the archaeology. As they have dug things up, they've realized, oh, well, we were wrong. The Bible is right after all. But there are three major fields where science claims it has disproved the Bible quite often. The most recent, evolution. And evolution has, as far as I'm concerned, fallen to pieces among anybody with any intellectual integrity. It used to be possible to be a believer in evolution and maintain some intellectual integrity. Nowadays, so much has come up in microbiology which just shows evolution to be untenable, that you have to be either a liar or totally closed. The honest atheists have admitted that evolution is untenable. A particularly famous one, Anthony Flew, he was one of the signatories of the Humanist Manifesto. He's reckoned to be the most influential atheist philosopher of the last 50 years. He was Richard Dawkins' hero, and a few years ago he admitted that evolution simply cannot stand up under microbiology. And so he abandoned atheism, because you have to abandon atheism if you abandon evolutions, and he became a supporter of intelligent design, much to the chagrin of very many atheists who had looked upon him as their hero. And there are many like that. There is David Berlinsky. He is an excellent mathematician and philosopher and speaker and writer. He's not a Christian. I think he's bound to end up that way if he carries on looking for intellectual honesty. But he's now a very powerful spokesman against evolution, even though he's not a Christian. So I think anybody with any intellectual honesty nowadays admits evolution is out the window. It is a past theory. It was good while it lasted, but it's gone. The next big attack on scriptural inerrancy is the millions of years of geology. Now, that is coming apart. It hasn't fallen apart like evolution has. But it is no longer really tenable. Just to give you an idea of the attitude of the geologists nowadays, about 2 years ago, might have been 3 years ago, I was invited to give a series of lectures at Free State University. I gave the first two lectures, and then the head of biology and the head of geology went to the university authorities and demanded that I be banned from the campus. And the authority said, all right, you ban me from the campus. And so the remaining lectures had to be held off the campus. Now, the people who had organized these lectures were from the maths department, and they were really amazed. And they wrote to the geology department and the biology department and said, but look, how come you're doing this? Are you unable to defend what you are saying? Said, you know, we in the maths department, if someone shows that what we are saying is not defensible, we would be happy to abandon what's not defensible. Now, why are you not prepared to answer what he's saying instead of banning him from saying it? And they didn't respond. So they attempted for a year to arrange a debate between me and the biology department, or between me and the geology department. Both refused. Now, the reason they refused is because they know perfectly well they cannot maintain their story. They can only maintain it if, you know, they tell the story and there's no challenge. Just over a year ago, there was a big Darwin centenary event at the university, and they had a week of lectures. And I contacted the university and said, is there going to be question and answer allowed after the lectures? They said, no, no questions and answers. They know perfectly well they cannot stand up to question and answer, so they won't allow question and answer. They know they cannot stand up to debate, so they won't debate. And they know full well that the only way they can carry on giving their story on the university campus is for nobody to challenge it, because it's so weak, it can't stand up to the challenge. So those are the most recent, that was evolution. The one before that, geology, it's millions of years, it is on the brink of crumbling the same way that evolution did. And the third one is the first attack, the attack that came through Copernicus and Galileo, and that is geocentrism. The Bible shows the Earth is the center of the creation, and the popular story has it otherwise. The Earth is the center of nothing. Now, all the observations show the Earth is the center of everything. And the only way that anyone has devised to be able to explain away all the evidence that the Earth is the center is by Einstein's relativity. Now, in his book, Relativity, the Special and the General Theory, he explains why relativity is needed. He says, we all know the Earth goes around the Sun, but it's been impossible for observations to be found which show that that's the case. Therefore, we need my theory, which says it's impossible to tell whether anything is stationary or anything is moving. But wait a minute, if you cannot tell if anything is stationary and anything moving, how do you know the Earth is going around anything? So the whole point of relativity is this allows you to believe that the Earth is not the center of the universe. And if you allow Einstein to be shown to be wrong, which it certainly is, then you're faced with this first attack on the Bible. Its inerrancy there's no attack that now stands. If those three go, There is no attack on the accuracy of the Bible. So you dare not allow a relativity to fall, because that's absolutely disastrous. It is far worse to admit the Earth being the center of the universe than to admit evolution. Far worse. It's a far bigger blow to atheism than the loss of all those millions of years. And there's only Einstein can maintain the story. So you dare not let him go. You dare not let him be proved wrong. When Herbert Dingell came across this really simple proof, he was absolutely astounded. Why won't they publish it in the journals of science? I've read one book called Relativität tegen het Licht by Feinheisen. He's a Dutch physicist. And in that book, there must be at the very least 100 proofs that Einstein's relativity is wrong. At least 100. But do the authorities face any of them? No. There is so much in the engineering and communications field that relies on the true behavior of relative motion, the behavior of light, the behavior of radio signals, that it didn't really take very long for many people to discover relativity is just plain wrong. But the journals would not publish their papers. So Thomas Barnes and Piotr Beckmann and one or two others started a journal called Galilean Electrodynamics, where they would publish papers like this, because everything to do with satellite synchronization and things like that, it cannot work with relativity. You have to work with other theories. You've got to chuck Einstein out. And so the important stuff in those fields is in Galilean electrodynamics. So all the people in that field, they subscribe to that journal, but the authorities in science, the scientific mafia, do not accept that as an accredited journal. So although there are as many articles in there as you want disproving relativity, that is not science, because science is only what the accredited journals publish. It's an amazing situation. It's really an amazing situation. And Herbert Dingell was very concerned that everything to do with nuclear power generation is done under the umbrella of Einstein's relativity. And he said, but look, this theory is wrong. We're looking at very dangerous possible consequences in using it. It's amazing.
How might Einstein, who spent so much time in the Word and writing more on theology than on science, how might he have then arrived at this theory, which is now being used as a point to discredit the Bible?
Say Einstein studies
Newton.
Newton. Newton spent more time on the Bible, on the scriptures,
okay, right,
than on science, but Einstein didn't. Yes.
I just want to ask a couple of questions about light. Genesis 1, God said, "Let there be light." Often you hear this argument, but there was no sun, and so maybe you can just comment on that. And then also, you know, you said once that light, the speed of light is not constant. Mm-hmm. If it's possible theoretically to, you know, make light stationary, what would happen? Would it break down as an energy and fall apart? Or
I don't know, but this has certainly been done. So light has been slowed down. In the last 10 years, it was slowed down refers to about 20 kilometers an hour. Then it was slowed down to walking speed, and then they got it to stop. They could stop light and then start it again. So it would appear that you can get light to go any speed from zero to 300,000 kilometers a second readily. Now, this 300,000 kilometers a second is what you can measure close to the Earth. I am quite convinced that experiments that have been done show that the speed of light increases with the distance from the Earth. There are a lot of very difficult to explain phenomena which are explainable if that's the truth, and the most obvious and the most serious is the Pioneer anomaly. Now, the Pioneer anomaly not only involves the Pioneer probes, it involves the Ulysses probes and the Voyager probes. Every probe they have sent far enough away for this effect to start to show, it starts to show at around about the distance away of Pluto. They all show exactly the same effect. They show that a radio signal sent out to the spacecraft and then transponded back again arrives more quickly than it should. It arrives before it is supposed to if that satellite is where the dynamics say it should be. Now, the original explanation that the NASA team thought of when they found this with the first one was that there must be a gas leak, and that gas leak was exactly away from the Earth, so that it was acting as a jet slowing the thing down, because it is slowing down as if there is a force pushing it straight back towards the Earth. Now, that was a reasonable guess when there was just the first one. Then when the second one got far enough to show the anomaly, that was in a completely different direction. You know, they sent these things in all different directions, and each one has shown the same problem. There appears to be a force pushing it straight back to the Earth in every direction. So the people at NASA realized, you know, this cannot possibly be what we thought. A gas leak acting as a jet, slowing it down. So they threw this question open to the scientific community. That would be in about 1993 or 94, I think. And there was a tremendous stir about this. Everybody realized this is really significant, because if there is if there is something that they cannot explain by gas leaks, then it means there's something wrong with physics, because we assume that the laws that we can measure here, the things we can measure here, they're valid everywhere in the universe. That's an assumption. It's an assumption that the speed of light is constant everywhere in the universe. But this is a perfectly reasonable assumption if the Earth is nothing special. If the Earth is just any old place in space, then it's a pretty good assumption that what we find here is what we'll find elsewhere. Of course, if the Earth is special, if the Earth is the center of everything, then there's absolutely no reason at all for believing everywhere's just like the Earth. So, from the comments that were made by the various scientists looking into this, it was obvious they were scared stiff to admit that one possibility. Because if the Earth is special, then all their assumptions about everything are wrong. All their assumptions are, because the Earth is nothing special, everything that happens here must happen everywhere else. Now, as soon as you accept the Earth as special, you can explain all these things by a very simple explanation. The speed of light increases as you go away from the Earth. That's why we are getting the signal back quicker than we should, because it's travelling quicker than we thought. It's going quicker out there than the 300 kilometres per second. Therefore, we get the signal back quicker. Now, as soon as you accept that, you've got explanations for all sorts of things. Like, for example, ultra-high energy cosmic rays, gamma-ray bursters, things like that. They all just fall into place as soon as you've got an increasing speed of light running away from the Earth. But that is the absolute pits as far as the secular human is concerned, because if the Earth is the center of everything, it's special. My goodness. And the Bible says it's special. The Bible says, Psalm 91, the Earth stands fast and cannot be moved. It says the sun, in Psalm 19, the sun has a circuit. It says his going forth is from the end of his heaven, and his circuit is to the ends of it. Now, if the sun's got a circuit around the Earth, that's really going to knock Copernicus and Galileo out, isn't it? It's going to completely destroy that attack on the Bible. And then you look at Genesis chapter 1, and what's the first thing created? The Earth. And when are the sun, the moon, and the stars created? Day 4. It really looks as if the Earth is something special, doesn't it, if you look at the Bible? But as soon as you start admitting it, it's a huge blow for the secular humans. It's a bigger blow than admitting that the billions of years don't exist.
You have spoken to us about DNA and the lots of information which is found in the DNA strands. And when... who's the guy who introduced evolution?
Darwin.
Yes, yeah. When Darwin spoke about the cell, he spoke about the simple cell. And today we know it's not anything but simple. And there's a movement today, or many scientists are starting to move towards intelligent design, saying that the information which is there obviously couldn't have evolved. It must have come from outside. And they're talking about aliens. Some people might admit it's God, others aliens. Is this move towards intelligent design progress towards coming back to biblical creation, or is it another good thing?
Oh, I'm sure it is progress. The people who hate the gospel because they love sin, they are very reluctant to give up evolution. The evolution, in effect, says you can do what you want because you're just an accident. You're only a mutated blob of goo. So, anything you do, it's not your fault. You're an accident of nature. You can live the way you want to. There's no responsibility, and you will never be judged for what you've done. Now, if you want to live a life of sin, you want that worldview. And if, when the evidence finally soaks in that you have to admit evolution's wrong, then you've got to try and wriggle your way out of a personal creator God, and you've got to look for something else. So intelligent design is something that people who realize evolution is isn't tenable, but don't want to accept Christianity, go into. But there are intellectually honest people who keep on looking. And if you are intellectually honest and you actually look, you will end up at the Bible. There are plenty of people who have followed that route. You know, people intellectually honest looking at the various religions. And if you honestly look at the other religions and go into them and see what it's all about, you see the inconsistencies, you see the fact that they just don't work. And if you are actually looking, you end up at the Bible because it is the only one that stands. All the others don't. So it's a tremendously good first step to get away from evolution. It's only a first step. And I think it's going to be a pretty slow progress from there, because the people who have come out of atheism because they saw that things were not intellectually tenable, they have still got to be won over to the truth. There's a great problem with reaching someone who doesn't want to believe. And that problem is given in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, I think it's verse 10, where it says, because they did not maintain the love of the truth, God has sent them a strong delusion that they should believe the lie. Now, even if you can show them things don't work in their rebellion, if God has sent them the delusion, they're not going to see the truth. The way for them to see the truth is for them to stop hating the truth. You know, when I was an atheist, I hated the Bible, I hated Jesus like all the other atheists did. But I didn't come to the light by finding the faults in the science. I came to Christ because a group of Christians who I'd never even met began praying for me, because my wife told them what a hard atheist I was and what an anti-Christian evangelizer I was. So this group of Christians who'd never met me began praying for me, and they prayed for me for 18 months. And the Lord is faithful. He answers the prayers of his faithful followers. And shall we say, kicking and screaming and struggling against it, his power overwhelmed me. And he brought me to my knees before him. And I came because he saved me. Not because I'd realized that evolution was wrong. Not because I'd realized the millions of years were wrong. But simply because God in his power worked in my life. And once he worked in my life, it was as if the scales came off and I was able to see all these lies I'd been believing. And that is, I think, the way God works. If you can come to love his truth, then he'll take away that strong delusion for you to believe the lies. Yes.
Shouldn't we, as the Christian community and those who believe in creation, just make our voices heard more loudly, in some way, stand up for the truth and not allow these lies to just be propagated towards our children and whatever, or at least make our voices heard and speak out against it, you know?
we should. And
I mean, yes. I sent an email to National Geographic. I don't know, we watched one of their programs on TV or something, and it was just full of this evolution lies. And I sent an email to them and I said, you know, you guys need to stop just disinforming people, telling them lies, and projecting your humanistic faith as the truth when you know perfectly well that it's not, it's just a theory. Needless to say, I didn't get a reply to that email, but I mean, surely, you know, if more of us did that kind of thing, I mean, the person receiving that email and reading it somewhere along the line, if he's getting hundreds and thousands of these emails, might start him thinking for himself, you know, that maybe what he believes is not true.
Yes, well, the Bible says you must study to show yourself approved, and you must be ready with an answer for the faith that is within you. And the faith that is within you, it has to include why you don't believe evolution, because if you do believe evolution, then you cannot have faith in the Bible. You must have a reason for why you don't believe in the billions of years, because if you do believe in the billions of years, you obviously don't believe in the Bible. You have to look into these things and have an answer. Now, most people don't. The most that most people do is maybe go to a lecture and then go away and think, oh yes, well, I've got good reason for not believing evolution. But if you're faced with the secular humanist lecturer at the university, and he is intent on laughing your religion to scorn, do you have the answers to be able to refute him? And if you don't, you're not doing what the Bible says and being always ready with an answer for the faith that's within you. And it's not difficult to get this kind of information. There are plenty of websites which you can get a huge amount of information from, showing that evolution's fallen apart, showing that there are huge questions with the billions of years. Now, you won't find many that are pointing out the fallacies of Einstein. There are very few. In fact, well, there's my website, but but at least on the evolution and the geology, you can get vast amounts of material, and there are very good journals like the Creation Ex Nihilo Technical Journal and the CRSQ. Now, that's not all that easy to read, it's a bit technical, but there are very easy to read things like Answers or Creation, which, although not technical, they have some good stuff in it. But most people don't bother. I have been to give lectures, and at the end I've overheard people say, oh, well, yes, but I believe in Jesus, I don't need to know all this stuff. Well, it's all right, you know, you believe in Jesus, but can you give an answer to someone who needs to know the reason for the faith that's within you? If we cannot give an answer, then it's just through laziness. It's not because the answers are not there. And you're absolutely right. We should be doing this. Now, don't expect that you will ever get into the media like this. When I first started giving lectures like this, people would come to me from the audience and say, this is amazing, we must get this on television. I've got a friend who is a TV producer. will you agree to come and do a series on television? So I said, if you can get any television program to do my programs, I'm very happy to come. Now that has happened many times. And no television program is prepared to have me speak. Because the message that they're putting out, they are bound to put it out. They will be shut down if they try and give a message that's not approved by the people who hold the purse strings. The people who hold the purse strings are not Christians. The people who hold the purse strings do not want any attack whatsoever on secular humanism. Because the people who hold the purse strings, the top ones are not even just they're not secular humanists. They are what they call themselves Luciferians. Their god is Lucifer. You'll have to look deeply to find that, because they keep it pretty secret. And the only way really you will find out much is when you come across people who've been saved out of it. I haven't met many people who've been saved out of it, but I've met a few, and the control of the radio and the television by the Luciferians is very tight. So there's no chance of getting this on radio or television. The only way that you'll get it is the way I'm doing, speaking to a group of people that you can get together. So that's the way it should be being spread, from person to person. But to do that, you need to do the work and do the studying so that you can answer those who want to know the reason for the faith that's within you.
Yesterday in your lectures, you mentioned to us how the evolutionists have these many frauds in their evidences which they point to, and this is what they rely on. Are they able to present any real evidence which is not fraudulent, or could they use carbon dating as well, which I understand is not accurate? Is there any real evidence which might point towards evolution?
Well, that's an interesting question which was looked at by Philip Johnson, who is professor of law at, I think, the University of California at Berkeley. A very well-respected law professor. And he produced a book called Darwin on Trial, in which he looks at the evidence that's being put forward for evolution. And he concludes there is none of it, not one piece of evidence, which could stand up in a court of law. So there is the evidence they put forward, but it is weak, it's controversial, it is biased in its presentation, and as soon as you look at it carefully, you see it all falls apart. I don't know if you remember, about 3 or 4 years ago, there was a big thing about Littlefoot. Do you remember Littlefoot? It was one of the finds from somewhere like Sterkfontein Cave, and the people who were dealing with it, one was called Smith, one was called there was Philip Tobias, and they were saying, oh, their measurements show that this thing must have it must have walked this way and must have walked that way. So I followed the discussion among the paleontologists on this. And the first comment I looked up, it was from another anthropologist in America. And he said, well, taking measurements like this, you can prove anything you want. Now that's the paleontologist's themselves admitting, you know, commenting on these stories that put out, wonderful, these measurements prove it. And he says, taking measurements like this, you can prove anything you want. So, even the paleontologists are not impressed. Yes?
You live in a day and age of sort of genetically modified foods and that kind of thing. What's your general view, or can you comment on that? Yes, it can be positive.
God knew what he was doing when he made what he made. Now, there was a film, Jurassic Park, made by atheists, and it had an atheist mathematician in there trying to put forward the idea that evolution is sustainable, you know, it's believable. But he made a very, very sage comment, and these people were juggling around with DNA, and he said, you know what they're doing, it's like allowing a little child to play with their father's gun. That's exactly what it's like. These people are like children. They know so little about what they're doing, but they know enough to be dangerous. It's like children playing with their father's gun. And nobody knows what's going to be the result. There are reports that I've heard that are very disturbing. We'll have to see if they are confirmed. But in anything like this, you can guarantee God knew what he was doing when he did it in the first place. And these people don't know what they're doing. They're playing with their father's gun.
Is there something we should be doing? Because, I mean, the chances are everyone in this room is eating that kind of food already. And it's sold everywhere.
It is, and there is one very good thing that you should be doing. You should be growing your own food. Even if you can't grow all of it, even if you're living in a flat, at least you can sprout beans and peas and seeds and things. You can put a set of plant pots on your veranda, and at least grow some of your food.
When we hear from the average evolutionist how many millions of miles an hour everything is flying around in space, and how fast everything's going, and how much we're hurtling through space, how is it that I can go outside and see the stars in the same spot every night and use it to be able to plan directions and map work? Because if everything is moving as fast as they say, why is it that Orion's belt and the Southern Cross and so on are so identifiable? Wouldn't they be different? Wouldn't we be seeing different stars every night?
Not if the distances are as big as they tell us. Now, the dimensions of the universe that we are being told are absolutely huge. So huge that if these things are moving at that kind of speed, it would take centuries to notice any difference. Now, I can't tell you whether the distances they are telling us are too big or too small, but I can certainly tell you they are wrong. I suspect they are vastly too big. I suspect the universe is very, very much smaller than the standard story. But I could be wrong. It might be bigger. The Bible guarantees that we will never know. If you look at Jeremiah, I think it's chapter 31, the whole chapter is telling us that God will never abandon the seed of Israel. He may punish them, but he will never abandon them. And then I think it's verse 37 where he says, if the heaven above can be measured, or the earth beneath searched out, then I will cast off the seed of Israel for all that they have done. Now, the rest of the chapter is assuring us he never will. That means the earth never, the heavens never will be measured, and the earth beneath will never be searched out. Now, it's interesting that he puts those two together. And the scientists of this world have attempted both to sound out the earth beneath and measure the heavens above. Now, they've attempted to measure, sound out the earth beneath by using seismic waves. And if you look in the earth science textbook, you'll find very confident statements about what is down there under the earth. That's not because anybody has been down there to have a look. It's because they've tracked seismic waves, and they said, well, look, the only way we can explain these is if the earth is like that in the center. But there's no guarantee their interpretation is right. Now, their interpretation of these waves says there must be something very funny, something they call the Mohorovic discontinuity, at something like 11, 12 kilometers below the Earth's surface. That's at the closest. Under the mountains, it's much further. So, because they weren't really totally confident that their interpretation of these seismic readings is actually accurate, they decided to drill a hole down to the Mohorovic discontinuity, and they called it the Mohole. And to their surprise, they found they couldn't get down to the depth to reach the Mohorovic discontinuity. And the problem was, the conditions that they were drilling through was utterly and completely different to what the theory had said it was. And in particular, there was so much water there that it washed away their drills, and they simply couldn't get a drill down deep enough. Now, if in the first 11 kilometers it's utterly different to what they had worked out, then what confidence have we that 6,000 kilometers deep it's any better? It's going to get worse the further you get away from the surface. So I think you can pretty well guarantee all those confident statements in the earth science textbooks, they're wrong. There have been three attempts to get down to the Mohorovic discontinuity. Every one has failed, and failed dismally, and I think they've abandoned the attempt of ever getting there. And conditions are utterly and completely different to what their seismic readings had told them in the area they have been able to get down. So, it's clear, God's right on this. If they can sound out the earth beneath, they can't. And if they can measure the heavens above, well, they give you confident distances. You read and it tells you it's so many million light years. Well, the Bible guarantees there's one thing we know about those figures they give us. They are wrong. In order to make a measure, you have to make assumptions. The first assumption is always that the earth is going around the sun. That's the first one you always make. The next one you have to make is that the speed of light is constant everywhere in the universe. As far as I'm concerned, both of those have been disproved. And even if we did look at the right model, they're looking at a completely wrong model. They're analysing the universe assuming that everything came out of a Big Bang. That's the model they interpret everything in terms of. That model's wrong, therefore all their interpretation must be wrong. But even if we look at the right model, the model that the Bible says, we still wouldn't be able to calculate those distances, to measure those distances, unless we know how the speed of light varies as we move away from the Earth.
Uncle Philip, what's the furthest that man has travelled away from the Earth?
The moon.
What's the furthest we've sent a spaceship that could beam back information back to us?
Well beyond the orbit of Pluto. And that, or that information that it is sending, as far as I'm concerned, is showing pretty conclusively that their assumptions are wrong, because the speed of light is getting faster as it goes away from us. So that is a tiny fraction of the distance to the nearest star. It's a tiny fraction.
So how can we be confident about distances beyond what any measurements have gone? How can we measure something beyond the reach of the furthest satellite that's ever been sent out?
As far as I'm concerned, the things they can measure with radar, they have got a pretty good distance to, and that is only out as far as certainly Saturn, maybe Uranus. I'm prepared to accept those distances. Everything beyond that is based on theory, which is based on assumptions and guesswork. So any distance beyond what can be measured with radar, which is pretty close to the Earth, as far as I'm concerned, the only thing I know about it is it's wrong. The distances we know
are wrong. So would it be correct to say that the quote you gave yesterday, science is what can be measured, anything else is not science. Therefore, when they're telling you distances beyond Saturn, are they not, or Pluto, are they not in the realm of fantasy rather than science?
I think so, yes. They're not real measurements. They are deductions based on assumptions. Now, everything to do with the so-called proofs of relativity are based on indirect measurement. There are no measurements that will confirm anything in Einstein's relativity. There are interpretations of things like cloud chamber tracks. There are interpretations of things in terms of Maxwell's equations. But any sort of measurement in terms of a mass measured on a scale, no. Anything in terms of a length measured with a ruler, no. These masses are worked out taking things like cloud chamber tracks and assuming what's happening is understood. But real measurements, no.
How do those distances that were measured with radar fly up with the theoretical calculation? And if their correlation is fairly close,
It's good correlation with Newton, to the sort of distances that radar will measure, but we're looking at the universe at vastly bigger distances than that.
And could it not be assumed that if that correlation is good, that the calculations would apply for further distances?
That's what everybody assumed. And when the pioneers and the voyagers and the Ulysses started showing it's not true, this is the reason for the big panic